Connecticut Democrats, or Connecticrats, as they have never been called.
Welcome back to Connecticrats, the CT Dem State podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Tara Kamen.
And I'm David Kostek. Have you seen anything good on TV this week?
Nothing really that interesting. Just a little bit about immigrants and how some people are trying to force them to have transgender surgeries. But
oh, that's a show I didn't see. I thought I got to the end of TV. I thought I had seen nearly every good show out there. Is this like some sort of crazy show that you watched?
It's this like new plot line they're experimenting with called the U.S. government. It's really an interesting thing they've got going on.
All right. So where did you watch? So this is, obviously debate time, and set the stage for me. Where, were you by yourself? Were you with some friends? What was going on? How did you watch this thing?
So I'm a Connecticut college student, and I have never in my life seen this many students interested in something political happening. We have two on-campus coffee shops, Coffee Closet and Blammel, both of which were packed with almost 100 people in each coffee shop. We had the LGBTQIA Center and Free Center at my school also having about 50 people each. And this is a small school. So this is a school of 1,800 kids. So this kind of turnout is kind of wild. And then we had dozens of students milling about on the green with computers in hand, watching the debate. The energy was great. I've never been on campus for presidential debate before. So seeing that and seeing that kind of excitement about this debate and people's reactions was just incredible and makes me happy because all these people are voters and they seem to be heading in the right direction with their votes.
I know UConn Dems hosted a watch party. I didn't hear back from anyone there. I didn't reach out or whatever. It'd be interesting to hear from other campuses around Connecticut what was going on. I was at one of the state party organized watch parties, the one in Hartford. We were in Parkville Market, which for listeners who aren't familiar with Parkville Market, first of all, you should be because it's kind of awesome. It's sort of like a Faneuil Hall, a mini Faneuil Hall in Boston with various food vendors all along a central long area with like picnic tables. And they reserved a big section for us, gave us a mic and speaker and put the debate up on the screen, like a big jumbo screen. And then what happened, in addition to quite a few people turning out, which was amazing to see, and I was really grateful to see, people come in just thinking they're going to Parkville Market to grab some dinner and joined us. You know what I mean? They're like, oh, this is interesting, and like wandered over and had their meal while watching this debate. It was fantastic from the get-go. I could not believe what I was watching. Certainly as someone who has seen way too many presidential debates, because I do watch them all going back many, many years. It was absolute knockout.
I think that I have very rarely seen a presidential candidate be as well rehearsed and well prepared as Kamala Harris was during this debate. I think that she had some pretty challenging big goals and things that she needed to do this debate, one of which proving that she was not going to be a Biden debate repeat. A big one was really emphasizing that she is a change candidate and really like pushing that contrast between her and Trump. And then also just turning people's focuses forward and not so much focusing on the past, which she did such a great job at bringing the point back home every single time they propped her up with a question. And my favorite thing that she did was the continuous baiting of Trump and almost feeding him his buzzwords and then letting him, like one of those wind-up dolls, just spew out the things that he says over and over again, just highlighted how nonsensical he truly is and his points are.
Let's listen to a highlight reel of nonsensical Trump. I don't even know what to call them. They're not even fantasies. They're.
I would say rhetoric, but I don't want to respect it that much because
no rhetoric. No, you can take a course in rhetoric. It ain't rhetoric. I don't know what it was. Y'all have probably heard this already, but we would be remiss in our duties as podcasters if we didn't roll it.
Now she wants to do transgender operations on illegal aliens that are in prison. People don't leave my rallies. We have the biggest rallies, the most incredible rallies in the history of politics. They're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets.
That's not the kind of thing you usually hear out of former presidents. You know, there's like this unwritten rule that once you leave the presidency, you sort of retreat into private life and don't really speak out much. I feel like Trump should have followed that rule.
I mean, there's a lot of memos in life that I think he misses. Big ones being like telling people that they turned a race that they always were, or I don't even need to get into all of that. But one of the big things that I hope at least is really important to voters is how after 9 years, this presidential candidate doesn't have a healthcare plan. I'm really hoping that that gets highlighted. I think it might be missed a little bit given like the bigger buzz things that happened. Him doubling down on saying that climate change was a hoax is another thing that I think was kind of swept under the rug, but is also incredibly important. But also just the way that he was talking about like the Israel and Palestine issue and his relationship with world leaders was really strange. I don't know. I just thought that that way he went about speaking about it was very weird, how he said that there wouldn't be a Ukraine invasion if he wasn't the president.
He tends to have an awfully inflated sense of his own abilities, particularly, it does bother me that people do seem to think that like economic conditions were really great under his presidency. They objectively were not. And that's even pre-COVID. And then the disastrous handling of COVID exacerbated all of that stuff. My question, it's sort of rhetorical question in my head. I don't think we can answer it until November 6th, is what kind of coattails this may have in Connecticut? What kind of down ballot effect we may see here in Connecticut? And one race that we will be watching very closely is in the 28th State Senate District. And that is the towns of Fairfield, Easton, Newtown, and Bethel. And our candidate is Rob Blanchard. I sat down with Rob and we talked at length about what he's learning at the doors and the difference between being a campaign worker and now being the candidate and what that does to a guy. This is Rob Blanchard here on Connecticrats, the CT Dems podcast. So Rob Blanchard and I know each other from back in the day, about 6 years ago. We worked together on a campaign that wound up being extremely close. And now you're a candidate running in a campaign that is likely to be extremely close. What do you find is the difference between being kind of a campaign worker, whether that's doing, field work or doing communications or whatever it might be, versus being the candidate where you kind of got to think about it all?
Well, Dave, it's great to be with you, and thanks for having me on. That campaign 6 years ago was a lot of fun, and I think we did have sort of the wind at our back, and a lot of people thought that Connecticut was going to go red, but Ned Lamont and the great team that we have certainly kept the governor's seat blue and had some coattails that gave him a great majority to work with in Hartford and really have helped to turn our state around. For me, it is funny to be on this side of it because just last week when we were marching in the Newtown Labor Day Parade, I had to remember that I'm the candidate and I'm handing out candy to people and trying to fire up the crowd, not the guy in the back taking pictures or waving signs. And so there's a lot of times that I've got to remind myself that I'm the one that I'm supposed to be helping to promote. And so it's funny a lot of times, but having that sort of campaign, first nature has been super helpful in thinking about a strategic field plan and kind of having the ability and knowledge to go door to door and hear from voters and listen to the things that matter most to them. And so having those tools have definitely given us the momentum that we need to kind of hit the ground running early on in this campaign.
And I imagine when you do go out the doors, which, by the way, Rob is doing a lot of doors. So if you live in Fairfield or Newtown or Bethel or Easton, you're probably going to get a visit from Rob Blanchard. I imagine you go into it with like, okay, here's what I want to say. Here's what I would like to talk about. But then very quickly you find out that may not be what the voter wants to talk about. So what's the difference there? And what are people talking about the most? I can probably guess, but what are they talking about the most to you?
And that's another funny part of this whole thing is that you gave volunteers and campaign staff a script to go read when they go to door to door. And you go into the spiel about who the candidate is and what they're campaigning on. what I've found to be most effective is when I go door to door, I introduce myself to folks, but I put it back on them and I say, I'm here to listen to you, or I want to know what issues or concerns you might have in this year's election, or in your town or community or at the state level. And so rather than kind of going in there with a sales pitch, it allows me to really gather information and hear stories that I think would make me a more effective legislator than the incumbent that we currently have here. A lot of the issues that I hear about are related to affordability in our state. I think we've got incredible schools here, but a lot of people feel, as they do across the country, the increase in the cost of living and things like property taxes, utility bills, the car tax, and a lot of these things that we enjoy our quality of life, but come at a cost for young families or seniors or small businesses. And that has really been my focus, is finding ways that seniors can afford to stay in their homes and age there, that young families that are just getting started here or maybe moved up from New York, or in my case, I hear about a lot of families that moved up from Stanford or Norwalk because they wanted a backyard. They want to stay here. They want to make it here, and they want to raise a family here. And businesses want to come here and thrive, and businesses that are growing here want to stay. And so how can we partner with them to make sure that they can truly afford here and have an affordable and good quality of life?
Of course, there's a lot of aspects to a good quality of life, right? And that's one of the things that I point out about Connecticut all the time, is that, you know, anytime there's these rankings, we're always very high, and we're high for a couple of reasons. Good schools and access to healthcare. I mean, that's something that our state legislature has certainly prioritized, even in periods of time when the federal government has sort of dropped the ball. So what are you hearing from voters, and what's your sort of framework for what you can do about it?
Connecticut has done a great job in terms of really making sure we've got access to high quality healthcare, removing some of the barriers, but that doesn't mean that there isn't more that we can do. A lot of the small business owners that I sit down with will tell me that their highest cost is either healthcare, or that's their second highest cost behind rent. And so I think that we need to look at ways that we can expand the pools of individuals that are maybe in trade associations such as brewers or CPAs or independent banks, to sort of allow them to use bulk purchasing power, or power numbers to have access to better quality and lower cost health plans. And for seniors, if we can find ways to cap the cost of prescription drugs, or again, use, as Governor Lamont has done a great job doing, kind of bulk purchasing or pool purchasing to offset those costs and bring those costs down, I think that those would be really important steps that we can take. But another thing that is not just within healthcare, but it's our workforce development that's important. We need to recruit more people into healthcare and incentivize them to join the field, because we need more people to take care of our aging population, just like we also need more teachers for our children and more people in public safety and things like that. And so all of these things, housing, we need people to come here so they can have a place to live if they want to be a teacher in our communities, or a firefighter or a police officer or healthcare worker, are important. Making sure that they've got access to good quality and affordable healthcare, and again, that they can raise a family here and have the life that they envision for themselves.
On Tuesday night, there was a presidential debate, and we've been talking about it here on the podcast quite a bit, and I'm sure people around the country have been talking about it quite a bit. And you know, issues like gun violence and abortion rights come up in that context, and you'd hope that there would be a erudite discussion among equals about varying visions for the country, but of course that's not what we see at the federal level. Therefore, it falls to the states, right? So far, that's just the world we live in. That these decisions are going to be made at the state level.
So first on the debate, I do want to say that some of these the times of the DNC speeches and the times of the debates, I wasn't sure I was going to be able to stay up to the end. Last night's debate was just incredible. And I not only did I stay up until the end, but I watched the post-debate coverage and I went to bed energized, which made it hard to fall asleep. But I think Vice President Harris did a phenomenal job laying out what I truly believe in, which is an opportunity economy. And she really gave people something to believe in, something to fight for, and a vision for this country that's going to move us forward together in a more united and opportunistic way that, that is really going to lift up all of our communities and our nation as a whole. And I think we certainly saw the contrast with that, which is former President Trump creating more division, more chaos, and really not having a plan or a vision for this this country. I had undecided voters and Republican friends of mine even texting me saying that they were very impressed with her performance, that she exceeded their expectations. And I think that last night she really delivered a vision for this country that's going to move some of those more undecided voters our way and hopefully motivate some people to pick up a clipboard this weekend or come out and vote. We're otherwise maybe going to stay at home because they were having a difficult time choosing which candidate to go for. On the issue of abortion and health care, I think unfortunately you saw what President Trump proudly stated that he created the Supreme Court that destroyed and reversed Roe. And that is really a concerning sentiment to have. Connecticut has led the way on access to abortion and reproductive health care and IVF. And I think we need to continue to ensure that we are a beacon for people who are unfortunately in states that don't share those values and those ideas. And on the topic of gun safety, we see a lot of school buses heading to school and kids getting excited to go back to school. But just last week, we saw another tragic school shooting. And so a lot of parents who I talked to at the doors have shared that they're worried about dropping their child off at school or whether they'll see them when they pick them up again. And that's an anxiety that no parent should have to have. That's a feeling that no child should have to have while they're at school, learning and enjoying time with their friends and their teachers and mentors. And so I think it's important that Connecticut really continue to advance our position as a leader on the issue of gun safety. I think we did an excellent job of enacting red flag laws in 2021 that do save lives. And while my opponent does not share the view of the importance of red flag laws and oppose them, I do think that we need to take a look at our red flag laws and make sure that they're up to date and that we're incorporating the best data and research and analysis into them. You know, if a child who's battling mental health is in a home where there is a firearm, and that parent may care about their child and they may want to ensure they're getting the best help available, are they storing that gun properly? You hope so, but in the event that they're not and that child decides to turn to violence, we want to make sure that we're able to intervene and make sure they don't have access to those weapons and create the kind of tragedy and harm that we saw in Georgia. These are Connecticut values, ensuring that we've got access to health care for women, that we've got smart, common sense gun safety laws are important. And while my opponent has voted to with his caucus to weaken and water down some of these important laws that are helping to save lives, I think it's important that we see what more can be done to protect our students and protect really anyone in public places, because sadly, gun violence is happening in our communities. It's happening in houses of worship. It's happening on campuses. And we really need to think about how we can help to protect lives and also make sure that people that are battling these mental health challenges do have access to the resources they need to get better and address these challenges without resorting to violence.
If you're listening to this and you're liking what you're hearing, you should help Rob get elected. I'll make that pitch directly. You said something about grab a clipboard and walk a neighborhood is by far the best thing you can do, but there's going to be phone banks as well. Check out ctdems.org/events. You will find everything close to you. I know for a fact there are canvases in Fairfield. I know for a fact there are canvases in Newtown and in Bethel, and I'm sure some of them go down into Easton as well. Or is that up into Easton? They go to Easton as well. So by all means, get out there in those four towns or wherever you live in Connecticut and grab a clipboard. Help our Democratic candidates this cycle.
We are going to be out this Sunday and Saturday all over the 28th District. Saturday in Fairfield is a big day of action at 10:30. Come down to the headquarters. This race is going to be decided by a small number of votes. My opponent only won by 1% or 600 votes last time. And everything that we do this cycle to flip this seat is going to be the difference. It's been red for 50 years, but the momentum, the energy are all on our side. I know with a lot of the help of volunteers in our communities, we can flip this seat once and for all.
Rob's race is very likely to come down to just a handful of votes, one way or the other. We'll have to see on November 6th. And we'll also, shockingly, get back to the top of the ticket. It seems to be a 50-50 race. And part of me wonders, like, when they're talking to these focus groups afterward, and part of me just wants to reach through the TV screen and like, scream. And then, like, how can this possibly be the case? There was a famous David Sedaris joke in the Clinton-Trump race, which described being undecided in this race as, you know, being offered the difference between chicken and a pile of excrement. And you ask, how is the chicken cooked? You know, like, there's no way to be that on the fence here. However people are. What else emerged? What else did you key in on this debate and think may have an effect on that elusive undecided voter?
In a way, I feel kind of upset that Kamala and her campaign even need to do this. But the way that they have been, you know, reaching across the aisle and being like, there is a place for you in our campaign, even if you are not historically a Democrat or you haven't had a long term history of supporting like liberal policies, because this truly isn't about politics anymore. It's about our government as a whole, like, maintaining its integrity. And one way that I think she really tried to reach across the aisle is mentioning that, like, she is a gun owner and she does oppose confiscation. And even though that might not be the most popular view in the Democratic Party, I do think that polling shows that Americans as a whole are more so aligned with that. And her bringing in that median voter, I think, is going to be really critical to this race and tipping that 50-50 balance that they have going on.
I've heard that exact same rhetoric lobbed at Joe Biden, who was elected president and confiscated precisely zero guns, at Barack Obama, who was elected president twice, 8 years. Guess how many guns he confiscated in those 8 years?
Absolutely.
It is a number between one and negative one, zero guns. They lobbed that at Bill Clinton, elected twice, 8 years, zero guns confiscated. It is not a thing on anyone's agenda, even in states like Connecticut, California, Massachusetts, and others that have sort of robust gun violence prevention laws, the kind that we're hoping to replicate in Washington. There's not a confiscation regime, right? There are red flag laws, and there ought to be. And there are assault weapons bans, and there ought to be. But that assault weapons ban doesn't go retroactive in any way, where someone goes around knocking on your door in the middle of the night. On the other hand, Trump is proposing, and Project 2025 spells out a plan to, you know, federalize troops to go door to door looking for people who might be immigrants. You know, like, this door knock in the middle of the night ain't going to be to confiscate guns. It's going to be a Trump initiative targeted at, you know, just more of his racist anti-immigrant nonsense.
Another thing that Kamala talked about that I thought was incredibly powerful and important is she is not a politician that shies away from talking about Israel and Palestine. And I think that a lot of politicians are very scared to touch that topic. But she did such a beautiful job at, I think, balancing the issue and communicating her full and true point without letting Trump kind of muddle her one way or another. And it got to a point where I think he said something like, she is bad for Jews and bad for Arabs. And then that kind of nulled the point completely, because it's like, no, that's not at all what she said. And you are neither swaying the rhetoric one way or another by saying that either. So that was a great moment to watch for me as well.
I have a hard time gauging where, you know, people's opinions may shift on a candidate when they hear a response like that. Like, I genuinely don't know. You know, on many college campuses, of course, the Palestine issue is front and center, the source of protests and the source of probably a lot of conversations around that coffee shop. Do you hear anything? Are you picking up anything in your circles?
I think that students were very frustrated about how scared politicians were to touch this topic because of how contentious it is. And for a very long time, many people were dodging the question and breezing over it. And in that moment in the coffee shop when Kamala addressed this issue, I heard people saying, finally, someone is saying something. Someone is standing on some place with it and taking a moral stance on it as well, and not being afraid to take a moral stance on it. And I think that is the kind of bravery and commitment to leadership that college students have been wanting to see from their leaders for a very long time. Although it might not fully align with everybody's beliefs 100% of the time, something was said. And that is, in my opinion, the most important thing.
Shortly after the debate, another event transpired that may move some particularly young voters into the Kamala Harris column, or at least get them off the sidelines and into the game. There is someone named, let me check my spelling here. I want to get this right. Taylor Swift, who then said she was going to be not only encouraging others to vote and to register to vote and staying sort of value neutral, but affirmatively said that she's voting for Kamala Harris. That's where she came down, encouraged everyone else to look into, you know, issues and come up with their decision for themselves. And interestingly to me, sort of started it off by tying it back to Trump's use of an AI-generated image of her allegedly supporting him and her concerns around AI, which have got to be profound for someone in the public eye as much as she is. So, did the Taylor endorsement hit hard?
So last presidential election, she endorsed Biden right before the VP debate, which I think is like a very roughly similar timing to when she decided to do it now. My opinion is she's been meaning to do this for a very long time and was just waiting for the best time to do it for it to have the most impact. A couple points that I loved about what she said. One is how much she emphasized researching the candidates. And because she has a very young base, and I don't think that those people necessarily know how much personal work it is to take a look at people's policies or lack thereof, in Trump's case, and see which one really applies to you and speaks to you. And the second thing that I really liked was her signing it off as Childless Cat Lady. That was a really good tidbit and a well-deserved hit at J.D. Vance that definitely was great to see.
Let me get in a little plug for our merch store. If you would like a Connecticut Cat Ladies for Kamala t-shirt or mug or sticker, store.ctdems.org. Get on that. That was amazing. I mean, my wife is a huge Taylor Swift fan. Went to one of the Eras Tour shows at Giant Stadium, MetLife Stadium. Sorry, it's MetLife Stadium.
In New Jersey, by the way.
A little shout out. Little shout out. She is a big fan, and was kind of hoping that this would happen as well. And it's just again, like everything, remains to be seen where the numbers fall. We did get some voter registration numbers in Connecticut recently. From the time, I've been waiting for this to happen. It takes a little while, a little lag until we get an update on the data that we can see in the party. And in Connecticut, the voter registration after Kamala announced. So if you look at January 1st to July 20th, the day before she announced for president, it's pretty consistent how many people, what percentage of people were enrolling in the Democratic Party versus Republican, how many women versus men were enrolling, were registering to vote. And of course, that was very close to 50-50. And how many voters between 18 and 24 are registering. All of those categories spiked significantly after Kamala announced here in Connecticut. So 18 to 24-year-old voters are now a bigger percentage of the population. Democrats are a bigger percentage of the population. Women are a bigger percentage of the voting population following Kamala's announcement. I fully expect that that will continue past the point where we can see now into August. And now, am I going to see an even bigger spike in 18 to 24 enrollment?
I think that you definitely will. Her reach is incredible. Her connection to her fans is incredible. And listen, even if it's not necessarily her being like, I'm going to vote for Biden, and a Swifty being like, okay, I'm going to vote for Biden too. It might just serve as a reminder to people to register and go out to vote. And even that, I think, is powerful within itself enough. So hopefully we will see those numbers continue to tick up.
One thing that is certain to help those numbers tick up, at least the voting totals to tick up, is volunteering for a campaign near you. Or you can even hop on the phone and make calls into swing states. We can help you do all of that. Go to ctdems.org/events. Rob Blanchard in the previous segment mentioned some canvases in Fairfield and Newtown all over his district. But I got to tell you, wherever you live in Connecticut, there are people ready to give you a little bit of training, give you a list of doors to go knock. And if you can do it, nothing is more effective than canvassing a neighborhood and door knocking. It's a great way to spend a couple hours on a weekend. It's a great way to spend a couple hours in an evening. And you'll see that most of our candidates who win close races will have knocked thousands and thousands of doors. If you can pitch in and do 50, if you can pitch in and do 20, please come out to something, ctdems.org/events.
Coming up, we're going to be also doing an analysis of the VP debate, so please stay tuned for that. Hoping it'll be a little bit less sensational and more substantial than this debate was, but I'm sure Walls has got it and is going to take the cake just like Kamala did.
I got to tell you, the only thing I remember from the Kamala Harris-Mike Pence debate is the fly. The fly landing on Mike Pence's head. That's all I really remember.
I'm hoping for a bee or a wasp this time.
All right. We'll talk to you next time on Kinetocrats, the CT Dems podcast. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.